call our third case for today, 06AP-1094, 06AP-1956, Hefty versus Daniel Strickhauser. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Strickhauser is attorney Paul E. Benson. Counsel?
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Paul Benson, and I'm from the Milwaukee office of Michael Best and Friedrich. And along with my colleague, Joseph Olson, we represent the defendant respondent petitioner, Daniel Strickhauser, and the defendant, ADM Alliance Nutrition Incorporated. The legal issue in this case has been addressed in the party's brief and does not need to be repeated here. The practical issue involved, however, we believe does need to be articulated. And that issue is this, where, as here, an attorney fails to respond to a summary judgment motion in a timely fashion, should that lawyer be given a pass when he admits that the reason that he missed the summary judgment deadline was because he failed to read the circuit court's scheduling order? The circuit court in this case, the Honorable Michael Gibbs, said no. Judge Gibbs struck the plaintiff's untimely submission and ultimately granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment after determining that the defendant's submissions made out a prima facie case for judgment as a matter of law. The Court of Appeals, however, said yes. And the Court of Appeals did so by relying upon the notion that because Judge Gibbs did not explain on the record and with particularity why the exigencies of this specific case necessitated a deviation in the circuit court's scheduling deadlines from the default deadlines contained in Section 80208 sub 2, he committed error. The defendants believe and contend today that the Court of Appeals was wrong for at least three reasons. First of all, the relevant statutes involved in this case contain no requirement whatsoever that the circuit court explain on the record and with particularity why the exigencies of this specific case necessitated a deviation in the circuit court's scheduling deadlines from the default deadlines contained in Section 80208 sub 2.
Counsel, let me interrupt you at that point. That may be true, but the case law seems to indicate, the Hunter case seems to indicate that that's what's required. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, because what the Hunter case reaffirms is the notion that a scheduling order can, as the statute says, unless earlier times are specified in the scheduling order, can alter the deadline between the statute and the scheduling order itself. I think that in Hunter and also in the Court of Appeals order here, both of which come out of District 2 and both of which involve cases involving Judge Gibbs and Walworth County, that at least in this case, Your Honor, I think what the Court of Appeals did is created a straw man. They juxtaposed the Walworth County local rule against the statute and reaffirmed a principle that we do not dispute, and that is that where there is a conflict between those two, the statute controls.
But doesn't Hunter basically require that there be some explanation by the judge on the record as to why he or she is not following the statutory time frames?
Your Honor, that is correct. That is what Hunter says out of District 2. And as we have argued in our briefs and we argue here today, with respect to that aspect of Hunter, we believe it is wrong. The circuit court in this case, first of all, we argue the circuit court did explain why in this particular case did explain why they used a different procedure other than 80208 sub 2. What the District 2 said in our case, the Court of Appeals in our case said that that wasn't good enough because it wasn't particularized to this specific case. Nothing in 80208 suggests that that is necessary. In fact, I would submit, Your Honor, that what is required under the statutes is consultation pursuant to 80210, and subsequent to that consultation then between the court and the parties, a scheduling order is then generated. And so long as the deadlines with respect to summary judgment are not earlier than the motion being filed 20 days prior to hearing and earlier than the response and responsive affidavits being filed 5 days prior to the hearing, the court may set whatever dates it feels are appropriate in that particular case.
Counselor, what case do you rely on for the proposition that consultation under sub 10 is satisfied by the questionnaires that were sent?
Your Honor, I do not rely on any particular case. Within the statutes, the word consultation and consult is not defined anywhere in the statutes. We note, however, though, that the common meaning of consult and consultation from the Oxford American Dictionary is that in order to consult, one must seek information or advice from. And in this particular case, we believe that consultation requirement was satisfied by the scheduling questionnaires because the order that accompanied the questionnaires, which were sent to my office and the Office of Opposing Counsel, both indicated in the order that a scheduling order would be generated based on the information that was contained therein. Both parties submitted scheduling questionnaires to Judge Gibbs, and Judge Gibbs' ultimate scheduling order specifically states that the information that he obtained from the parties was relied upon in generating the various deadlines. And it's actually, in looking at the scheduling order in this case, it is clear that he did take into account what the parties had indicated, because there is a deadline for summary judgment, and on our side, we indicated that we would need one. He indicated he took into account the parties' estimates with respect to the number of expert witnesses and the number of lay witnesses. He even took into account the fact that the parties had similar recommendations with respect to the length of the trial. So I personally found it very troubling, and I'm certain that any circuit court that was being reviewed by the Court of Appeals would find it troubling as well, that it was suggested that he may not have relied on that information because the evidence is that he did.
Well, counsel, I want to ask you about that because in looking at paragraph 15 of the Hunter decision, the court in Hunter, Court of Appeals, said that the practice of simply appending local rules without any showing of an exercise of discretion violates the Supreme Court's expressed intent to bar application of local court rules conflicting with Section 80208 sub 2 and to impose statewide uniformity of practice. And I understand your point that, as I understand it, the judge had this information before him that he sent out the questionnaires. But where in the order is there any showing of an exercise of discretion or the process that the court goes through in making that type of determination?
Your Honor, I think the fact that the court acted is in and of itself evidence of an exercise of discretion. At least in my experience as a practitioner in this state for the last 18 years, I can tell you that the circuit court judges that I appear in front of don't act for no reason. And so it is clear here that based on the evidence that I've just mentioned, that in this case, Judge Gibbs did take into account the parties' estimates as to time and witnesses, and he incorporated that in ultimately into the scheduling order.
The reason I ask the question is there are many decisions that we've held and that the Court of Appeals has held that decision-making is not synonymous with the exercise of discretion, and the exercise of discretion is a process of decision-making and certain steps that have to take place. And so when I look, I understand your point that, okay, we have the information that was sent out. We believe there was consultation, and this may or may not satisfy the consultation. But to have a decision does not necessarily equate to an exercise of discretion, and that's why I'm trying to pin you down. Where in the order is there any indication that there's an exercise of discretion as part of the decision-making process?
Understood. And for the explicit type of express statement that you're looking for, Your Honor knows as well as I do that it's not in that particular order. I ask this question. Should the circuit court have to do that? Who is in the best position in this case and in all the other cases on Judge Gibbs' docket to determine how this case should proceed? Obviously, 80210 requires consultation. And I will freely admit to this court that if you accept the position of my opponent that scheduling questionnaires are not sufficient to meet the consultation requirement, then this scheduling order is invalid because consultation is a prerequisite to any type of scheduling order being issued. Otherwise, our rules allow, the court need not even hold a scheduling conference, and the default deadlines that are contained in 80210 can simply take place. But here, where the court has consulted, and we contend that there was consultation, and where that information was taken into account, the court has generated a scheduling order that, with respect to at least the deadline for summary judgment motions, is expressly allowed by 80208 sub 2. That provision specifically exempts that unless earlier times are specified in the scheduling order, the following deadlines apply. And I expect that we are going to get into, at least at some point in time, Justice Prosser's concurrence in the Phelps case. I'm sure it's always interesting for you as justices to have both sides try to tell you what it is that you meant when you wrote something years ago.
Especially since he was concurrence and dissent, and everyone's quoting him. I know. I should concur and dissent more often so I can be quoted.
I would like to ask you a question, but it is not, what did Justice Prosser mean? Okay.
I can ask that question of you at some point.
You're free to answer. On page 79 of your appendix, this is part of the affidavit filed by Mr. Phillips.
Yes,
sir. In paragraph 4, I was also aware that Walworth County Circuit Court rules for civil actions, in particular paragraph 2B, what did paragraph 2B read at the time?
I'm sorry?
What did paragraph 2B read at the time? Did it read the same as 2B on page 102 of your opposing counsel's appendix?
No. And to the extent that the Walworth County rules may or may not have been inconsistent on the issue of motion practice, I will contend, Your Honor, is completely irrelevant here. If this were a situation where this scheduling order was generated without any type of consultation whatsoever, or there was no scheduling order at all, and you have this local rule in Walworth County that is sitting there, I believe the phrase you used was a potential trap or a snare for the unwary, I would agree wholeheartedly with the notion that the statute should trump the local rule and the statute should control. However, when you have a scheduling order, you have consultation, and the scheduling order is then generated by the court. It is an order from the court. And in this case, there is no dispute that counsel for both parties received it. The only way that there can be a problem is if someone doesn't bother to read it. And I cannot think, I am obviously not a circuit court judge and never have been, but I cannot think of anything that I would find more insulting than to issue an order from my bench and have the other side fail to read it. Furthermore, I think it's...
I think
happened two times on the same day here, in the same court in front of the same judge. Isn't that right?
Well, I don't know enough about Hunter, and the Court of Appeals noted in Hunter that the record was very incomplete in terms of what exactly happened in Hunter. It wasn't even clear if there were scheduling questionnaires. All I know for certain, Your Honor, is
but
what
it did
happened.
Happen on March 13th in front of the same judge.
Well, that's when there was
the same, at least I think it's the same sort of scheduling order. What I want to pin you down is on this. On 2B, are you representing to me, because I don't think we have 2B as it existed at the time. There was no reference to summary judgment in 2B at the time?
No, actually, Your Honor, I believe there was. I believe from my reading of the Walworth County local rule that was in effect at that time, if you read those Walworth County local rules in toto, there was an inconsistency in 2B and 4B, which is the provision that was substantially appended to the scheduling order and expressly made part of the scheduling order. But, Your Honor, I will contend that the Walworth County local rules are really irrelevant to the disposition of this case. And the reason that I say that is whether Judge Gibbs put that summary judgment procedure together himself, borrowed it from the Walworth County local rules, borrowed it from the Eastern District of Wisconsin local rules, or somewhere else, is completely irrelevant. It was made part of and expressly referenced in the scheduling order, and it then becomes the order that governs. And the only way that we are here today, the only reason we are here today, is because counsel failed to read it. And isn't it ironic that, as Your Honor indicated, there are these different local rules all across this state, potentially being snares or traps for the unwary. But look at the situation here. The lawyer who, by his own declaration, had practiced in Walworth County for 20 years is the one who did not pay attention to the local rule.
Well, look, and it was. Let me see if I understand your legal position. Can you have a local rule that is inconsistent with the statute?
We have them all over the state, Your Honor, yes.
Oh, I don't care if we have them. I want to know, is that lawful? Where does it say that a trial court or group of trial court judges or a district group can adopt local rules that are inconsistent with the statute? I thought the state legislature made up these rules of practice, unless they were modified by the Supreme Court. Where does it say the trial court can modify them?
Okay. Your Honor, the second question that you asked me was different than the first.
Okay. Answer anyone you like.
All right. Let me answer them both if I can. Okay, because you obviously didn't like my answer to the first one. With respect to the first one where you said, can there be local rules, the answer is yes.
Well,
right?
You mean there are?
Yeah.
There are. Okay.
And also the answer is yes. And let me answer the second one, because your second question was, if there's a conflict between the local rule and the state statute. And I think that's the answer you're looking for. No, you cannot have a local rule trump the state statute unless that local rule is made part of a scheduling order.
Ah. Now, where do you find that the local rule made part of a scheduling order can trump a state statute on practice?
The scheduling order can trump 80208 sub 2.
Why?
Because the first phrase of 80208 sub 2 is, unless earlier times are specified in the scheduling order.
But then it's not inconsistent. And the answer to my question is, and I know what that says, that the statute itself allows that. Therefore, the trial court order is not inconsistent. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So your position is that the trial court rules and the scheduling off order come within unless earlier times are specified in the scheduling order. But that isn't the way that always read, is it? When did the words unless earlier times are specified come in?
I believe in 1992, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, the rule that you have at Appendix 8 does not have that in. It has, it has it at the end, or at an earlier time only if specified. How does that fit with the note?
Well, Your Honor, there was originally a petition and then an amended petition. And in the amended petition, that is where this court specifically acknowledged the right of circuit courts to change these default deadlines by virtue of scheduling.
So that note isn't applicable to the ultimate provision that was drafted. Doesn't the note say that they afforded minimal and there was a plethora of local court rules? Now requiring it is designed to preclude local rules and promote uniformity?
Your Honor, that is what the note says, but the page before, Appendix 10, has the new language added, the unless earlier times are specified in the scheduling order.
So that note is out, is that it?
Well, I don't believe the note is out, and I don't think that I hope the court does not believe that it is the defendant's position that we're trying to reject the notion of uniformity, because we're not. Uniformity definitely has its place, but it is a means, it is not the end. And at the end of the day, the circuit courts, we believe, have the power and should have the power to ascertain what the deadlines should be with respect to the various cases on their docket. I will confess to this court that in the entire time that I have been practicing, there was only one time in my entire career that 80208 sub 2 has been the summary judgment rule, and that was before the Honorable Leo Schlafer in Washington County. Every other court that I have appeared in this state, and I haven't appeared in all of them, but I counted it up. I've been in 30 different counties, has had a scheduling order. Now, sometimes the scheduling order has mirrored a statute, but in many instances, it differentiates itself from the statute. And I would suggest that that is for very good reason. 80208 is a fine default rule. But the fact of the matter is most cases that come before circuit courts involving issues of summary judgment are far more complex enough, I will contend, that a reply brief is appropriate. And 80208 sub 2 has no provision whatsoever for reply briefing. We note in our briefs to this court that this court believes there is utility in reply briefing. The Court of Appeals believes that. Both the Eastern and Western Districts of Wisconsin, the federal courts, believe that. Yet 80208 sub 2 doesn't. So if a judge wants to have a reply brief as part of summary judgment, he or she must do so by virtue of a scheduling order. Similarly, only 5 days to decide a summary judgment motion, especially in a complex case, before the date of hearing. I will confess that I, just the last 2 weeks, have been in the Milwaukee County Circuit Courts and been engaged in scheduling conferences there. And I can tell you that they are always setting different times for summary judgment disposition because, in Milwaukee County at least, summary judgment motions and other motions are all decided on Mondays. It's Monday morning motion day is what we call it. And if you only get your brief 5 days before that, it's difficult for counsel. It's terribly difficult for the courts. I mean, it generally ruins their weekend. And if you have a situation where a party like myself has moved for summary judgment and a response comes in, and then I want to file a reply brief, under 80208 sub 2, I need to bring a motion and file a brief, and that's even a shorter amount of time. So I would suggest that the way the statutory scheme is laid out is appropriate, because it allows circuit court judges the right, the ability, and the authority to say, this is not an appropriate time frame for me. I want to have more time to decide issues for summary judgment. I want reply briefing, and I want to be able to tailor the various cases that are before me in such a way that I can control my own docket. Now, in this case, Judge Gibbs freely admitted that the summary judgment procedure that was part of the scheduling order mirrored that of Walworth County. But again, I go back to my position, that should not matter. Because if the scheduling order is read, there should not be a problem. There is no problem where the unwary are trapped or snared because they have read the rules. And I do not think it is in any way, shape, or form inappropriate for us, for this court, to expect me and every other practitioner in this state to read the rules and the orders that come down from the courts. And if that had happened here, we wouldn't be here.
So your position is that this trial judge in the scheduling order gave a different time than in the statutes, and that's permitted both by a trial court order, general trial court orders, and the scheduling order. So everything's A-OK.
Yes, I don't believe that there's anything deficient about Judge Gibbs' order in this case. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Did the response comply with 2B in the local rule?
Your Honor, I note that the red light is on. May I answer your question,
yes,
please?
You may.
Okay, thank you. My recollection of 2B is that it did not. That's 2B, I'm assuming that you're referring to, of the Walworth County local rule. Yes, I think that that 2B set a time frame that was more akin to something consistent with 80208. But as I indicated, in this case, the court didn't refer to any of the other Walworth County local rules. It referred specifically to appended summary judgment procedures that were printed out that just so happened to mirror that one provision of the Walworth County local rules that dealt with summary judgment procedures.
I understand your argument completely that the scheduling order should have been read from the first word to the last word. I understand that. But regardless of that, was Rule 2B complied with? Yes, sir. That's a yes or no, I think.
Was 2B what, Justice Prosser? I didn't hear the end of your question.
There is a Walworth County rule relating to pretrial and motion proceedings. We have an updated version of that on page 102 of the hefty appendix. But I don't think we have the same rule as it existed back in, was it 2006 or whenever it was?
Yes, they were amended, Your Honor. My recollection of 2B is and I know you think that this is a yes or no answer. If you'll indulge me, I'll explain why I don't think it is, okay? I believe 2B is a 5-day rule, okay, in terms of responding. However, the facts in this case are such that we were served by fax at 5:58 p.m. on what would be otherwise considered to be the fifth day. We were not served. We were served with the brief, but we were not served with any of the affidavits or other information, okay? So it's hard for me to say for sure yes or no. For
well,
purposes
it would
of
it seemed to me the opposing counsel says, well, I knew the other rule, and you would say, but you didn't comply with the other rule either.
That would be true, Your Honor.
That's what I will ask you.
Your Honor, and the only reason, and perhaps I'm giving Ms. Sullivan a gift here, and I could be, but I also, in the interest of fairness and candor, need to tell the court that we were also served by mail that same day. And the materials that we received by mail that day did include the affidavit and other evidentiary materials. So in some respects, if the court were to determine that we were served by fax, Your Honor, I would definitely be making the argument that I know you were trying to lead me to, but I have to, in the interest of candor, also let the court know that because we received those materials by mail, under the mailing rule, the mailing of the materials would be considered then timely and appropriate. And the only thing I would add to that, though, is that when you mail something 5 days before the hearing date, that's an even shorter amount of time for you and the court to analyze the materials. And again, that's one of the reasons that I think the circuit courts should be able to, as the statute allows, have longer periods of time.
How does your argument fit with the general rule that you want to give people their days in court, and that's why you don't have, you don't lightly give default judgments? So here you have a summary judgment because of, quote, a technical deviation from the time. I mean, who was hurt?
Well, I will contend that my client was hurt and the court was hurt. We were prejudiced by the late filing. I will contend further that the sanction that was imposed here was the sanction of striking the untimely brief. That distinguishes this case from the Marquardt case and some of the other cases that have come from this court, where the issue there was the sanction of dismissal with prejudice. Here, in this case, the sanction was striking of the brief. Our motion in that regard was granted. But then Judge Gibbs engaged in an analysis of the materials that we had submitted in support of our motion for summary judgment. He allowed our opponent an opportunity to have oral argument on the issue, notwithstanding the fact that he had not submitted his materials in a timely fashion, and ultimately determined, consistent with Section 80208, that the defendants had made out a prima facie case for summary judgment. There was no issue of material fact based on the record, and judgment as a matter of law was appropriate. The last component of my answer to Your Honor's question is that the plaintiff in this case does have potentially her day in court, and that is that she may, as Schneller, the portion of Johnson that was not overruled by this court in Marquardt, and the other cases that come out of this court in that line, she does have a cause of action against her attorney for his failure to exercise what I would consider to be, I mean, it is hard for me.
You're talking about malpractice.
Yes.
Okay.
She'd have to prove the validity of the underlying claim to proceed in that case, so you give her the double ups, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, but the only caveat I say to that, Your Honor, is that I understand that there are a line, and thankfully I've never been the subject of a malpractice action, and I don't practice in that particular area, but it is my understanding that there are some situations in which the focus is on the conduct involved, and that is virtually dispositive. I go back to the fact that I don't see...
Well, you wouldn't have any damages. If you proved the conduct was negligent, but you didn't prove the validity to an underlying claim, what's your damages?
That's true.
So I don't think you can get there without proving them both. But anyway, that's another case.
Understood.
Perhaps. Justice Brandley.
You made this distinction earlier between this case and another case where there is a dismissal with prejudice. But what's the functional difference if you strike affidavits that would raise competing inferences? So you have no genuine issue of material fact. Grant summary judgment. And that's it. What's the difference?
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with you if the summary judgment motion that was filed was essentially the state law equivalent of a Celotex motion. In other words, that all we were saying was the plaintiff has the burden on issue X. Plaintiff cannot come forward with evidence on issue X, therefore we win. Okay, that's the Celotex case in a nutshell, and obviously there are cases in which defendants, or plaintiffs, quite frankly, will bring those types of motions for summary judgment. But here, this was a summary judgment motion that was brought at the conclusion of an extensive period of discovery. There were a series of affidavits that were submitted, and there was a series of documentary documents and other types of evidence that were submitted. And it is not a foregone conclusion that simply because such a motion is brought, that it must be granted. The court must, as Judge Gibbs did here, take a look at that motion and determine whether or not it makes a prima facie case. And in fact, 802.08 sub 3 and sub 6 both specifically talk about the fact that that type of a showing needs to be made, and the David Christensen trucking case, which is cited by both parties, specifically states that as well, that it is not a foregone conclusion that summary judgment must be granted, that the court must take a look at that. Now here, Judge Gibbs found, and we believe rightly so, that our initial briefing on the summary judgment issue established a prima facie case. And you're correct, Your Honor. After he struck the brief, he was left with nothing in opposition thereto and ultimately granted judgment as a matter of law. But I think that is a far cry from cases in which the sanction is dismissal due to discovery abuse, or on the dismissal on the merits due to discovery abuse, or something along the lines that Judge Maudsley was faced with in the Marquardt decision, which is discussed by the parties.
So what you're saying, counsel, is that Judge Gibbs took into account everything. It's just that the other side didn't have counsel. Didn't have the benefit of counsel for the written briefs. Isn't that what happened?
That is correct, because he did allow...
the oral argument, but he didn't allow briefs. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I gather Mr. Olson will do the rebuttal. Is that right? You're going to do the rebuttal? Thank you. Ms. Sullivan, Sheila Sullivan, representing Jeannie Hefty.
Your Honor, may it please the court. The parties here appear to be in agreement on a couple of crucial points. Number one is that the local circuit court rules cannot trump state statutes. And the second is that the circuit courts have some discretion to amend scheduling orders to adjust the statutory briefing deadlines if they feel that's appropriate. And where the agreement between the parties breaks down is on the question of how much discretion the court has and how it must demonstrate that use of discretion. Now, Ms. Hefty would submit that attaching a local court rule to a scheduling order doesn't demonstrate an exercise of discretion. If it's the same rule that's applied to everyone that comes into that courtroom, a one-size-fits-all rule, that is the absence of discretion.
What about Mr. Benson's point, though, that, all right, we do have this local rule. It is one-size-fits-all. And everybody's aware of the rule, and counsel just didn't follow it. What, if anything, should take place at the point that counsel fails to follow the rule?
Well, there are other alternatives. I dispute that everyone is aware of the rule because, as we pointed out, there, in this case, in the Hunter case, the same day, two attorneys made the same mistake. So there's quite a few attorneys out there, apparently, that aren't aware of the rule. But if there is a situation in which someone inadvertently fails to comply with the rule, the court or the opposing counsel have options available to them. The other party, for example, could bring a motion to compel a response.
Let me tell you what troubles me about this case. As I see it, there's two things happening here, and it's kind of like ships passing in the night. On the one hand, there's the authority of the circuit court to have the local rule in place in the first place, and what steps the court has to do to establish a local rule. And I think it's clear under the statute, as I see the statute, that the statute does contemplate at least earlier times for local rules. So the first question is, what can the trial court, what can the circuit court do with the establishment of local rules, and how does the trial court go about doing that? But then the second question, and the different question, is the attorneys not following the rules that have been established. And so I see both things happening in this case, and I'm wondering which should govern the decision.
Well, I think part of the problem with this particular case is the way in which the local, the the statutory rule was modified. It was done through this rote order, which goes out with every scheduling order. And if the more common procedure had been used, then I don't think there would have been a problem. The most common procedure, in my experience, is that, and I think Mr. Benson would agree with this because he references it in his brief, is that the court calls the parties together for a scheduling conference, and everyone discusses, okay, is there going to be summary judgment briefing? How long do you need to do that? How long does the opposing party need to respond? That sort of procedure where everyone mutually agrees on the dates, I don't see how that would be a problem. I don't think that the Court of Appeals decision forbids that.
And it's quite clear that in this case that did not happen.
That did not happen.
If it does not happen, does an attorney have the ability or the right, I'm not sure which is the correct word, to ignore the rule?
I don't think that attorneys would do that. I mean, if attorneys are going to be practicing in front of these judges repeatedly, they're not going to blatantly ignore a request from the court. And in this case, it was an honest mistake. The question really is, what is the remedy to the opposing party if the attorney ignores the rule? And there are other remedies or potentially sanctions available short of striking the pleading as being untimely. And according to the statute, since it was timely, striking it would not be an option available to the court. So discretion has been described by this court. I got this description from the Marquardt case, paragraph 19, but it's been set forth in numerous different places. Discretion is a process in which the circuit court examines the relevant facts, applies a proper standard of law, and using a demonstrated rational process, reaches a conclusion that a reasonable judge could reach. That didn't happen in this case. The court didn't examine the relevant facts because the court didn't really have enough relevant facts before it. It had some fill-in-the-blank questionnaires. All it really knew about the summary judgment issues was the defendants wanted to file a summary judgment motion. So it didn't have a lot of facts on which to make its decision. And we have no way of knowing, based on the scheduling order that was issued, what kind of standard of law the court was applying or what kind of reasoning process the court was using. So there's no demonstration in this instance that the court was, in fact, exercising its discretion. And the fact that the same rule is used for absolutely everybody, in fact, is an obvious indication that the court wasn't using discretion. It was simply applying the same rule as a matter of habit.
Is this a scheduling order a form?
I believe so. The court asks the parties to send in questionnaire answers, fill in the blanks, and then it has a standard order where it fills in some dates. And that's my understanding.
Now, in relation to point 5 on the scheduling order, which is motion for judgment on pleading / summary judgment must be filed by, and they filled in 2/01/2006. The line under that, is that filled in or is that part of the order?
I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me. What is
it? It would be page 26 of opposing counsel's appendix.
Oh, see attached sheet for motion procedure. I would have to guess because I don't know, but my assumption is that is on all the standard form, and that the only thing has changed is the date there. There's a date filled in the blank.
Well, it's underlined the way certain other things are underlined.
It may have been underlined for emphasis, but knowing the way that we do things in law firms, there's usually some kind of form on a computer and some person in the chain of command fills in the dates. The judge might have told them what dates to put in. And again, I'm assuming I don't have other information about that.
Well, was there consultation in this case?
No, there wasn't, because consultation, as I explained, when there's a scheduling conference where everyone's in the same room and everyone agrees on the dates, that's a very different procedure. To just ask the parties, are you going to file summary judgment motions, which is all the judge really asked in his questionnaire, that's not consultation. If you're in a scheduling conference, the judge can find out, well, do we need to do discovery? How long do the parties need to do discovery? How long do they need to respond? Are there, you know, what are the issues? How complex are they? That sort of give and take goes on at the scheduling conference. And that didn't happen here with these fill in the blanks.
Suppose the scheduling order had said, with respect to that question five, response must be filed within 20 days.
I'm sorry, if the scheduling order had said...
Suppose right part of that scheduling order was response had to be filed within 20 days.
I believe that under the Court of Appeals decision, that that's not sufficient. I mean, that would have given more notice to the parties, and that would have been better. But because it deviates from the statutory standard, that there would have to be something more on the record, some explanation as to why.
Well, where do you get this explanation? It isn't in the statute.
Well, there's the general rule. You know, when the court makes a discretionary determination, that determination is subject to review. And in order for there to be meaningful appellate review, there has to be something on the record explaining how the court made that decision. So, for example, if there's a scheduling conference where everyone agrees on the dates, that would be an example of that would provide a basis for understanding how the court came up with those dates. Or I would even submit that if the court had put an explanation in there as to why it was necessary to have a 20-day response time.
Well, what about this entry? A motion for judgment on pleadings, summary judgment, must be filed by 2/01/2006. There's no explanation for that date.
Right, and I would say that because that date was more than 20 days before the hearing, that date was not enforceable either, at least in the respect of potentially striking the pleading for being late. So if the defendants had filed a few days later, they would have had available the argument that under the statute we didn't need to respond or to file by February 1st.
How do you know which entries on the scheduling order require explanation and which don't?
You'd have to be familiar with the statutes. If there's a contrary statute, then the scheduling order has to provide some explanation for why that's being trumped. And as a practical matter, attorneys do not just ignore the scheduling orders. If a judge says that I would like summary judgment motions by February 1st, 99% of attorneys are going to do that. And the other 1%, it would be a mistake. They forgot, you know, miscalendared or whatever. I don't see, you know, rampant abuse of attorneys in ignoring scheduling orders.
Counsel, let me ask. Let's assume for purposes of this question that we agree that there's no exercise of discretion here by the circuit court in terms of setting the scheduling order. Did counsel have an obligation if there was a problem with the order? Did counsel have an obligation to make an objection in advance prior to the order expiring in order to challenge the dates that were listed within the body of the scheduling order?
Well, counsel wasn't aware, obviously. Counsel believed that the statutory deadlines were the ones that were going to be applying.
But it's right in the order itself. Let me tell you what's troubling me. As a former appellate practitioner, I seem to recall an old line of cases that dealt with issues involving void and voidable orders.
Yes.
And if an order was not void ab initio, void on its face, the order was always considered valid unless and until it was overturned or stricken. And so from that perspective, when I look at this, assuming that we have an erroneous exercise of discretion or a lack of discretion whatsoever, the question is still in my mind, but can a lawyer, notwithstanding that lack of exercise of discretion, can a lawyer just not respond to the order at all? Can a lawyer let the order's dates come and go, and then after the fact come back and challenge the order? Or is there some independent obligation to force the court to exercise its discretion properly?
That is not something that I've researched.
Fair.
But I would, there, when this order came out, there was no intention not to comply with the terms of the order. So it's not something that I'm sure crossed trial counsel's mind at the time.
Thank you.
Well, counsel file motions for relief from scheduling orders on a fairly regular basis. If their case is proceeding and they find that they can't comply with certain orders or something has happened that's changed the complexity of the litigation, they file a motion and the court hears them out and makes a decision and changes the deadlines or amends the scheduling order. That happens pretty routinely. Why wouldn't that be the answer to Justice Butler's question?
Well, because that presumes that counsel knows that there's a shorter deadline that exists. I mean, in this case, he simply did not know that he had to respond within 20 days instead of 5 days before the hearing. Had he known that that was the shorter deadline, he would have responded by that. And yes, he could have filed a motion for relief, but that wouldn't have occurred to him because he didn't know that the shorter deadline existed.
What was the date of the hearing?
The date of the hearing? The original summary judgment hearing was March 13th, 2006.
And is that in this scheduling order?
I do not believe so.
Pardon me?
I do not believe so.
No, I don't
maybe
see
Mr.
it.
Benson can enlighten me, but I thought that was something that was established after the motion was actually filed.
Okay, so they followed the statute when this scheduling order was put out. The counsel wouldn't have known when to serve opposing affidavits 5 days before the day for hearing because the hearing wasn't set yet.
Not in the scheduling.
But would have known from the attached, and what's attached, see attached sheet for motion procedure. That's what the reference is, but the attached sheet doesn't say motion procedure. It says standard summary judgment procedure. Isn't that right?
Yes.
A little confusing, isn't it?
Yes. And as I believe I explained in my brief, that there are actually two different rules in Walworth County, and if someone just read the rules.
So which one was that referencing, the summary judgment procedure or sheet for motion procedure? Or don't you know?
Well, this procedure that's in here is the one that was attached.
Right. Okay.
You used to say
when I practiced law, attached and incorporated herein by reference. Then I knew that it was part and parcel. Doesn't say that, does it? People still use that expression, or is it old-fashioned? Maybe old-fashioned, but it's
no,
good.
No, it's not old-fashioned.
Attorney's
contracts do that.
Most contracts, if you want to put it in and make it part and parcel, you said,
yes.
And incorporated herein by reference. This doesn't say it. It's a C attached.
Well, we still use that a lot with pleadings, so.
What? Incorporated by reference.
Yes.
In fact,
yes.
Every time you state a new cause of action, at least the pleadings I've seen in this court, you always say, and we incorporate herein by reference paragraphs and then just set
yes.
them forth. Then
yes.
you know that they come in.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, if a majority of this court sides with you, Do you want us to march in lockstep with the Court of Appeals?
Well, I think that the Court of Appeals came up with the logical explanation of the problem, that the court does have the discretion to amend these scheduling orders, but that it has to show an exercise of discretion if it's going to impose a serious consequence on someone, such as striking a pleading for being untimely. So to that extent, I would agree with the Court of Appeals.
So you would also want judges, circuit court judges, to go on the record, call the case, have counsel present so that they can be heard, take a record of the scheduling conference so that their exercise of discretion can be proven by a court reporter, and then have that be
I don't believe that's necessary. I believe that the current system is working fine, which is this informal consultation. The only question comes in if someone wants to strike that pleading as being untimely. If the court followed the informal procedure versus the formal procedure, then striking the pleading wouldn't be an available sanction. But there are other things the court could do. For example, let's say someone doesn't respond by a deadline that they've agreed to in this informal procedure. The other side could file a motion to compel a response, and the court could then say on the record, yes, you must respond by thus and such a date for these reasons. And then the court could then make its record. And if there's...
I thought you were saying that at the time the scheduling order is drafted, if the court is going to deviate from anything within the statute, that the court has to state why on the record they're deviating so that it could be subject to review later.
I think in order to enforce its order in the way that the court has chosen to enforce it here, by striking the pleading, then that procedure would have to be used at some point.
Why that procedure? Why couldn't you just have complicated case, hyphen, need time to review response, period?
I don't know that it has to be that procedure. I don't think the Court of Appeals said it had to be on the record. I think that's Mr. Benson's suggestion.
On the record, on the record or on the record in open court. And I don't think Hunter necessarily addresses that. Maybe I'm wrong. Hunter says, as I recall, explain on the record why the deviation is necessary and appropriate.
Right. I don't see it. The Court of Appeals saying you have to have a court reporter. It just says there has to be an explanation in the record, and I would read that as meaning it could be written. I mean, there's some explanation somewhere.
It strikes me that when a lawyer or a client does not adhere to a court order setting times like this, there can be penalties. Question for me is whether the penalty fits the offense. So I could see motion costs against the person who doesn't file timely. I can see some kind of sanction like that. But to in effect say that the client does not get a lawyer to represent that person. I know that there was oral argument, but no brief. How does that penalty fit the offense and the concept that you don't favor default or you don't default judgments? I know this is not a default judgment, but in effect what you're doing is saying, hey, you defaulted, we're punishing you.
Yes.
We defaulted in part.
Yes. Well, I think this is, the court addressed a somewhat similar issue in the Alexander versus Riegert case, which involved a slightly different context where there was an amendment to the scheduling order, and the court said, well, you have to do a balancing act. You know, you have to consider the one side's preparation for trial versus the other side's interest in having their case heard. And in Alexander, as in this case, there, you know, where there's no prejudice to the other side.
They claim they were prejudiced. That's what he said up here.
They weren't prejudiced. I mean, the brief here was 5 days late. In the 5 days that they had before the hearing, they did, in fact, file a reply brief and a motion to strike. So maybe that required superhuman effort on their part. I'm sure it was more hectic than if they'd had 10 days. But they could also have asked for the hearing to be put off. And they could have asked, you know, for some other kind of sanction, such as, you know, costs. I don't know what costs, but they could have come up with something short of striking the brief as a sanction. And then Ms. Hefty would be able to get her day in court and have the court hear the case on the merits. And that was actually a point that I wanted to make sure to emphasize also, that the consequence of not following this procedure is simply that the brief can't be struck as being untimely. And the consequence for the court is that the court then has to read the brief and decide on the merits. It's, you know, it's not the end of the world. The court, it's a little more work for the court, obviously, but it provides fairness to the poor plaintiff who isn't responsible for her attorney's delay in filing this brief.
Mr. Benson argued, I thought persuasively, that Judge Gibbs listened to argument, heard argument from, I guess it was Mr. Richter, and it was a fairly substantive decision. Is that fair?
I do not believe that is a fair assessment of the situation. Based on my reading of the transcript, because I wasn't at that first hearing, it seemed he allowed Ms. Hefty's attorney to make an argument, but then ultimately just said, no, the brief was late, I'm not going to consider it, and then made it on the basis of the brief, made his decision on the basis of his brief being late. Later at that point, we came in and filed a motion for reconsideration, and at that reconsideration hearing, the court once again affirmed its decision not to strike the brief, and then also said, and oh, by the way, I would have granted summary judgment anyway, without an explanation into the record as to why. So if the court did make that determination, it hasn't provided us with a record as to why that was justified. So I would just like to conclude with quote from the Alexander case, where this court said, the constraints of a scheduling order should yield to permit a trial of the true controversy between the parties with full exposure of all available relevant facts. And that is basically what Jeannie Hefty wants here. She wants a full consideration by the trial court of all the available relevant facts. A 5-day delay in responding to a summary judgment motion is not so detrimental to the orderly administration of justice that it warrants dismissing her case without even listening to her side of the story. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. Mr. Benson?
In rebuttal, I would like to address a couple of issues, starting with the issue raised by Justice Bradley and the question of why can't we just simply say this is a complicated case and we need more time. Under the court's order in this particular case, that would not be enough, because we recall that Judge Gibbs made a similar type of explanation for why it was necessary to deviate from 80208 sub 2 in this case, where he said that we need to do this for the orderly administration of justice. And the District 2 Court of Appeals found that insufficient because they said that he must explain why in this particular case and comments on scheduling orders in general are not enough. So in answer to the hypothetical that you provided, Justice Bradley, Under the law of this case, if not reversed, that would not be an option available to circuit courts. Justice Abrahamson asked about the issue of incorporation by reference and the fact that it's not in the scheduling order. Of course, that is true. But at least from my standpoint as a practitioner, if I receive a mailing from the court that tells me to see attached, I, for one, assume that to be essentially the same thing. It is something that I'm receiving from the court that I am supposed to follow. And let's face it, every practitioner in this state is college educated and has an advanced degree. Our Bar Association holds us out to the world as expert counselors.
Mr. Benson, let me ask you a question. Trying to get a handle on what, if anything, should happen in this case. On the one hand, we have, I think under the Hunter decision, if it's to be followed, if we're going to follow Hunter, you have an absence of explanation by a circuit court here as to why the scheduling order should be a different time than that provided by statute. On the other hand, you have no objection to the scheduling order before the order is issued. So you have an attorney that has essentially not followed the scheduling order, and now it comes back before the circuit court, and now you have the motion to strike, the response. All right, so what is the circuit court's responsibility at the time that the motion to strike is filed to determine on the merits or on the facts of this record whether the sanction that it's about to impose, which is granting the motion, is appropriate, or whether the circuit court should do something else? Because I've looked at the transcript as well, and as I understood, even though there was an argument that was made by trial counsel, the circuit court's order was essentially, look, you didn't follow the scheduling order. We want you to follow the scheduling order. Because you didn't do it, this is gone. Did the circuit court have to do more at that stage? Granted that it didn't do the initial. Now we're after the fact. What is the circuit court's responsibility at that point?
The circuit court's responsibility at that point, Justice Butler, is dictated by 801.15 sub 2 with respect to time. Where there is a deadline contained in a judicial order and one seeks relief from that deadline, if they are seeking that relief prior to the expiration of the deadline, they must demonstrate good cause. If they are doing so after the expiration of the deadline, they must meet the excusable neglect standard. And while it is true, Your Honor, that that Judge Gibbs did not use the phrase excusable neglect, he asked Attorney Phillips why it was that he missed the deadline. And he had no answer. And ultimately, he filed an affidavit in this case after two motions for reconsideration. And I would argue that that addresses at least some of the concern that Justice Abrahamson had with respect to day in court. Two motions for reconsideration, including a motion for reconsideration, arguing that his conduct met the excusable neglect standard and a finding that it did not. That's what controls the decision at that point. If it's an untimely filed request for relief, then our statutes already answer the question, and they say you must demonstrate excusable neglect.
Understood. Did the circuit court in this case make a good cause finding? I didn't see it in the transcript, and I may have skipped over it. So I'm not sure I saw a good cause finding or an excusable neglect finding, at least in that proceeding. And so that's what I'm trying to pin you down. Did the circuit court actually go through the statutory findings that it was supposed to make?
Your Honor, I will contend yes. Two answers. Yes, and even if the court finds that it did not, it doesn't matter. The answer yes is based on the fact that Judge Gibbs made the inquiry. Okay? He made the inquiry of Attorney Phillips. Attorney Phillips gave the answer, and he ruled that that answer was insufficient. Would it have been preferable for him to cite 801.15 and the excusable neglect standard? Of course. It would have been much better. But he didn't do that, but I think that finding is that showing right there is sufficient. Secondly, in State versus Farr, which is one of the cases that we cite in our principal brief, We note that where the trial court fails to set forth its reasoning in exercising its discretion to admit evidence or otherwise, the appellate court should independently review the record to determine whether it provides a basis for the trial court's exercise of discretion.
Didn't the trial court set forth its reason for the ruling, at least the second ruling?
Yes.
It didn't follow the rules?
Yes, Your Honor, because on the motions for reconsideration that were subsequently filed, the excusable neglect issue was specifically raised at that point, and Judge Gibbs rejected it. And finally, I would simply indicate to the court that while this case is not maybe a large case in the context of the amount of money involved, it's an extremely large case in terms of the practice and procedure before these circuit courts going forward. If the court agrees with the plaintiff, I will contend that all of these scheduling conferences will need to be either made on the record or accompanied by a written opinion so that appellate courts will have the ability to determine whether there's an appropriate exercise of discretion. Furthermore, and perhaps more importantly, you will be creating an all-new area of appellate practice and procedure in this state. All of the default deadlines, or excuse me, all of the scheduling order deadlines in 80210 sub 3 will now be subject to attack after the fact based on the notion that perhaps discretion was not appropriate. For all of those reasons, I would ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate Judge Gibbs' original finding of summary judgment in favor of the defendant.
Thank you, counsel. For a five-day failure here, we have a trial court decision, a court of appeals decision, a Supreme Court decision, and a potential malpractice case. We'll take that under advisement. That closes the hearing on 06 AP 1094 and 06 AP 1956, Hefty versus Strickhauser. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. And then we are here for oral argument at 9:45 tomorrow morning. We are in recess.